Welcome to the UNLSA podcast. I would like to begin by acknowledging the traditional owners of the land from where I am hosting this podcast today. That is the Awabakal and Moromai peoples, and pay my respects to their elders past, present, and emerging. I extend that respect to any Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples listening. My name is Sian Picard, and I will be your host for the Careers in Criminal Law episode of the UNLSA podcast. Joining me today is Zoe Wetham, the founder and principal of W & Co Lawyers. Zoe is an alumni of Newcastle University and began working as a graduate solicitor in Sydney at one of the top-tier criminal firms. Zoe is an experienced advocate and has been listed as a rising star in criminal law by the Doyle's Guide in 2019 and 2020. Also joining me today is Susanna Fuller. Susie is also a Newcastle University alumni and a recent graduate, having been accepted into the Legal Development Program at the Office of the Director of Public Prosecutions earlier this year. Hi Zoe and Susie, and thanks for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
All right, I might get straight into our questions for today. So, I understand that no 2 days practicing as a criminal lawyer are the same. But for listeners to get a bit of an understanding about the difference between prosecution and defence, can you both talk me through a general day in your life? We might start with you, Zoe.
Okay, so my day in the life as a criminal lawyer is a little bit different for the past month or so since starting my own firm. It's been a bit more business focused at the moment. So I'll answer to what I've been doing for the last 6 years. I've been working in the city of Sydney. Living there, I worked among a team of 5 criminal lawyers and we had some support staff as well. I was a senior associate, so every day was sort of supervising other lawyers and then the support staff as well. I was involved in a bit of the business side as well with Streeton Lawyers, that was a firm. And other than that, of course, in terms of my role, we were a private criminal law firm. So I did a little bit of legal aid work, but most of the clients were private paying, which meant that there was a lot of focus on client management. And the way our firm worked is that we wouldn't share clients. We basically, a client would ring up a legal inquiry. And if I was the person to answer that inquiry or get assigned that inquiry, I'd speak to that client. We would retain them if they wanted to go ahead and then start from the very first mention at court through to the end, whether that be a sentence or a trial or a hearing. So we sort of spend a lot of time with our clients. Some matters go for years. I've had some clients for 3 or 4 years. So it was very client focused and of course going to court every day for bail hearings, sentences, trials, defended hearings in the local court. In conferences with clients and barristers. So that's probably a good snapshot. I guess in criminal law, the thing about it is that every client is different and every day is different. So I guess you never know exactly what you're going to get, but I worked for a really good team and I had a really good mix of matters in my practice. So every day was different.
And in terms of what you were just talking about then, Zoe, it sounds like the firm you were at was really client focused. Is that something that you thought was an experience you would have got at any firm, or did you think that was really unique to the way you grew and developed?
I think on one hand it's very familiar to all private firms, but I think at Streeton Lawyers we sort of described ourselves as a boutique law firm. So I guess we didn't have, we had a lot of matters and we were really busy, but we wouldn't take on too many matters so that I guess that would be to the detriment of our current clients. So it was really important to us to you know, really provide a first-class service to our clients. And I think they were really good skills to learn to bring over to my practice as well. It's not so much about getting as many clients as you can. It's about the impact that you leave on that client and how they feel throughout a pretty scary process for them. So, yeah, I'm really glad that I learned those skills there and can carry them on.
Yeah, that's a great insight. Thanks. And I guess flipping over to the other side of the bench, what's your experience there been like, Susie?
So the DP page tends to have 2 major kind of departments within the offices. They'll have a short matters group and trial groups. in the main part of New South Wales, so where you've got Gosford, Newcastle, Sydney, Parramatta, Penrith, most of their short matters will come to us in the Sydney CBD. So I work in the head office and I'm in the short matters group. And the short matters group, what we deal with is we deal with Supreme Court bail applications and district court appeals. That's kind of the bread and butter of what we do. We'll pick up sentences from time to time, but the main things that I will be doing each day will be collecting files, having a look at them, looking at the material that we have, seeing if we have all of the required material to tender. So for bails, you kind of want their criminal history, a bail report, any subjective material, the court attendance notices and the facts for every matter that is they're requesting bail on, and the police have an opportunity to present their views to the court. So we have to liaise with the officers in charge for each matter. In terms of appeals, it's very, very similar, except you're going to want to request the material from the local court that they're appealing so that we can have a look at the merits of the appeal, determine what our position is. And in both cases, submissions are written. The trial groups run in a very different way. I spent the first 6 months at the DPP in a trial group, and that is spent kind of like defence work. You spend a lot of time on one single matter. So you'll have anywhere between 10 and 20 trials at any point, but they're not all running. So you can obviously only be in one courtroom at one time, but you'll have matters in committal stages, doing charge certification or case conferences where you meet with defense and you meet with the accused person and talk with them and see if there's any way to resolve the matter. But you basically are going to be juggling quite a lot of matters in different stages in a trial group. But that comes with its own challenges in terms of managing competing priorities. But I really enjoy the short matters group that I'm currently in because every day is different. Every day you'll have 10 to 15 matters in court. You wake up, you go in, you have a look, you start getting it ready. And then within 2-3 days, it's in court. So it's very fast paced, but quite exciting, honestly. Mm.
Yeah. And I guess listening to that recount, it does sound fairly fast paced. Do you feel like as a young graduate that you're getting the support from higher in the organisation and the mentorship at the DPP?
Absolutely. Everyone's experience is obviously going to be different, but at the head office, the two groups that I've been a part of have been really fantastic. So my first trial group, basically you'll have the clerks and the legal support staff, which is me, and then above us are solicitors. You've got level 1, 2, 3 solicitor advocates, trial advocates, and then a managing solicitor. And the managing solicitor is the person who's going to provide you the most support in terms of they've been exactly where you are, but so are all the solicitors. So they've kind of the atmosphere in the office, even though it's quite large, is that you could pretty much approach anyone with any issue and talk to them. And in short matters, because we're constantly on the go, I'm working with two different solicitors every day because I'll tend to have a bails list at any one time and an appeals list at any one time. And so the solicitors are going to be requiring different things from me and there's constant communication. And in the short matters group, that's actually where you've got the most clerks out of the entire office because we are so busy. In trial groups, you only have one or two graduates, but there are 8 of us in the short matters group. So it's a very, very collegiate feeling. And it's been a really great start to criminal law, really, being able to go through this and be surrounded constantly by other people who are exactly as clueless as me.
Yeah, wow, that's fantastic. And I guess that leads us on pretty nicely into my next question, at least for you, Susie, because I know you've just come out of it. Personally, I'm in my 5th year at Newcastle University and I'm going through the experience of transitioning from a law student to a graduate. And I know many of my colleagues and I would really love to know more about each of your experiences getting into the criminal law. And so I guess I'll throw this back to you again, Susie. Was it always your goal to practice in criminal law?
No, I'm in a pretty interesting position in that I always wanted to do family law or work in care and protection. And I was working in a family law firm for most of my last year and I really enjoyed it, but I think I wanted to do something just a little bit different, and the firm that I was at wasn't offering an ongoing graduate position for me. So I started applying for other places and experienced a lot of the usual rejection that you get when you're trying to enter the workforce. And I happened upon the legal development program application for the ODPP, and I thought, oh, should I? I'm not really sure if I've ever wanted to do criminal law. This is new, but my friends convinced me. They said, look, honey, like, you're getting rejected from everywhere. You may as well put your hat in. What's the worst that can happen? And then it's a 3-stage process, and every stage that I got closer to getting offered the job, I think I was more and more in shock of, like, oh my goodness, I might actually have to follow through with this. Is this really what I want to do? To anyone out there who's moving into the workforce, I would say don't shut any doors. Even if you think that criminal law is absolutely everything you want to do, and you see a job and you think, you know what, maybe, I'm not sure, maybe, you know, Department of Communities and Justice, that it's closed, I might just throw my hat in, just do it, because what is the worst that can happen? You decide that you don't like it and you keep trying. Like,
that's great advice. Really appreciate it there, Susie. And then I guess, Zoe, for you, was it always criminal law, or did you have other pathways as well?
Yeah, I feel like my advice is kind of a little bit opposite to Susie, in that my advice would be follow your heart, stay in your lane. And I say that, I really admire Susie, you know, stepping out of, you know, what she thought she was going to do and finding something that hopefully she's loving. It sounds like she is. I think that's really cool. But I guess in my experience, when I was at uni, I always knew I wanted to do crime. There was, I don't know why exactly. I don't have an answer as to why, but I always knew it's what I wanted to do. And I remember in second year, I did the criminal law subject and I did not like it at all. I had a bit of a quarter life crisis probably at that time. I was like, I thought this is what I wanted to do. If my advice to anyone who has that feeling after doing criminal law, the subject, practicing criminal law is very different, so stick it out. But I always knew I wanted to do criminal law, but then in fourth and fifth year, all of, you know, my friends at uni were all, you know, applying for their clerkships and internships with commercial firms, and I had this, you know, freak out that I should be doing that too and I'm doing something wrong, because I think it hopefully has changed a little bit now, but when I was going through uni, there weren't that many opportunities for people who wanted to do criminal law, and so I didn't really know what to do, so I started applying to commercial firms, but I'm glad that at the end of the day I sort of just followed my heart, and because I ended up where I am now, and I'm really grateful that I stayed focused on what I wanted, and as a result I've had some really good experiences. But I really started to enjoy uni in probably fourth and fifth year through the professional program, I think you still call it that, hopefully.
Yeah, something along those lines.
Yeah. So we obviously doing your, what do you call it, your prac hours, probably using the wrong terms. It feels like yesterday, but also feels like a long time ago. So yeah. Anyway, I did my prac experience at the DBP, and that was always my goal. I wanted to be a criminal lawyer and I wanted to work for the DBP.
That leads really well into my next question, I guess. Yeah. And so how come you didn't end up at the DPP and you went for more of the defence route?
So at the time at uni, they didn't offer anything at the DPP in terms of students and doing any practical experience. But I spoke to the lady who was the head of organising that at the time. Mm. And she was like, oh, I'll see what I can do. And then I think they hadn't accepted a student for maybe 4 years, 5 years or something like that.
Oh, wow.
Then I sort of worked my way in there. Hopefully I wasn't too annoying, but I knew it's really where I wanted to be. So I ended up, I think I was supposed to be there for like 3 months, and I think I stayed there for like 8 months. I just kind of kept turning up. And I loved it. I loved every moment of it. I really, really liked that experience. But then after that, because other students needed an opportunity to go to the DPP, I took a step out and I went to the ALS. And I literally remember the first day, it was like, oh no, this is what I want to do. And again, I don't know exactly the answer, the reason why. I think that like on some level, I feel like, yeah, the DPP is kind of where my heart was. But then I have, you know, this other side of really wanting to be client focused. And, you know, there's something really special about seeing someone in front of you and being able to listen to them and speak in, on their behalf. It can make such an impact to them, especially at their ALS, from people speaking with people daily who have been, you know, lived through contexts and experiences that are so unlike my own, that, yeah, just being able to be a voice for them, I found that really, yeah, I felt that that's where my heart was. I also did a bit of psychology at uni. I really am interested in the intersection between mental health and the criminal law. So, yeah, I think it was just the fact that, you know, someone's going through their worst day or a really difficult time, and some people have never had someone recommend that they engage in rehabilitation, or some people haven't even had someone to listen to them, or some people would just say, oh, I'll plead guilty to get it over with, and you're like, no, like, yeah, you know, the evidence is not there, or you've been wrongfully charged, or even if they are pleading guilty, you know, sometimes people will just think that they'll turn up to court and not realize the impact a criminal conviction can have on them, or not realize that they don't have to go to jail, there are other options open to them. And it's about really just demonstrating that for a magistrate. So I really like that personal side of that. And I think it's an important role. A lot of people, when you try and explain it to, you know, friends and family, you know, that they just assume that I'm a prosecutor, because I think if people knew my personality, that's probably where they think that I would be. I'm not that kind of typical idea of what you see on TV in terms of like a strong, loud, kind of maybe aggressive.
No Harvey Specters here.
No, that is not me at all. But I love it. I just love being able to help people. And it was really that experience of the ALS that turned me around. And then after that, I worked for a private firm. We had Michael Burke, who was the partner of Burke and Mead at the time. He's now a barrister in Sydney. But he was our advocacy lecturer, or I can't remember. I think he just came for a couple of classes. But that had a huge impact on me, because it was kind of like a mentor or a role model that I could see that was finally, you know, in criminal law, not commercial law, or, you know, there was a little bit of family law. But I think family law and criminal law, at least when I went through uni, was a bit of an afterthought. So seeing Michael there, I kind of approached him, and he said that he could offer me something at his firm. And then it was through that that I, through him, when I finished uni and had that, probably everyone does, like, where am I going to work? How am I going to get a job? All the rejections that Susie went through, I did the exact same thing, but you've got to persevere. And I volunteered at a trial in Sydney. It was the Z trial, which was a pretty big trial that went for a few years, but I was there for a couple of months and met some amazing barristers. And through that, they introduced me to my old boss, Justin, and I'm really lucky. I got a really good experience.
So it sounds like it was a lot of passion and also networking.
Exactly. I'm not someone who's super outgoing. And, you know, I remember actually I went to court with Michael. I probably would have been in my fourth or fifth year, and he was doing a plea that day, and he was like, so what are you doing to network? And it literally, I'm not joking at the time, I was like, but what does networking mean though? Like, I don't exactly understand. But now I can see the importance of it, and really following my passion and speaking up and reaching out to people really paid off for me. And so that's sort of the advice that I give to people who want to get into crime, is that don't be put off by the fact that no one else seems to really want to do that. It's worth it if you even want to give it a try. And like Susie, sorry, I know I'm rambling a bit, but like my husband, he's a criminal lawyer as well. We met at uni, but he really wanted to do family law as well. It's all he wanted to do. And I was a bit biased. I was like, oh, you should try criminal law. It's really good. And he did the same thing, moved from family to criminal law. And he absolutely loves it. I can't imagine him doing anything else. So it's good to at least try it if you're not sure. I think it's a really interesting and meaningful career.
I guess I might like take us back a little bit, Steph. I know you, Zoe, spoke about your psychology experience. And I know Susie has a particular interest in rehabilitation and going for maybe less of a traditional criminal law approach. But having that mindset and that empathy, I guess it can be difficult sometimes to switch off from work and home and make that distinction, because since criminal law can expose you to so many difficult topics. Would you guys have any advice or coping mechanisms for how you deal with confronting topics and working with clients who may not share your personal values?
interesting situation that I find myself in the DPP is I don't necessarily have clients who don't share my views, but there are other people who work within the DPP who aren't exactly the same mind as me. There are still some old souls in there who are quite adversarial in their approach and are very much hard on crime, whereas that's exactly the opposite approach that I take. I see the role of the prosecutor as trying to find the most just outcome and negotiating with defense counsel and talking it through with the judge or the magistrate to try and work out what's going to be best for both the community's interests and in the interests of the offender, because it doesn't, I don't think it serves anyone to be adversarial, but trying to work with people who don't exactly share my views can sometimes be a little bit conflicting. And it's really just having a really strong sense of you and why you're there. And that also ties into dealing with the really sensitive material and some of the things that you see is you really have to remind yourself each day when you go home, like, why am I here? Why am I doing this? What made me want to study law? And you might not necessarily have a good excuse as to, not like a good reason as to why you wanted to study law, or but it's more, why did I go for this job? Why am I staying here? What is this offering me? Because that's going to be the motivation to get you through the tough times to, like, I see quite traumatic material on a regular basis. The unfortunate problem working in the short matters is that people who are applying for Supreme Court bail are people who have been bail refused in the local court. So there tends to be, on some occasions, there's a good reason why they're bail refused, and then other occasions it's just maybe a stronger magistrate made a decision that wasn't exactly benefiting everyone. But there's all sorts of people come through, and we do see some quite awful matters and some quite awful material. And I just have to kind of look at it and go, you know what? I'm just doing the best that I can. And this is why I'm here. And this is what I want to do. And I want to help communities. And you just have to kind of be really strong and just push it aside and say, this is really awful. I acknowledge this, but I'm doing what I can because I'm just a person and I come to work every day. And I do tender bundles and I staple things and hole punch things. But that is what is in my power.
But it sounds like you have a really positive self-reflective practice in that sense. Zoe, I know you've been in the criminal law sphere a little bit longer. Is there anything that you've implemented in your own practice that might be a little bit different?
I think Susie's answer is really good. Just sort of having that self-reflection is important. I think at the end of the day, of course, everyone has a fundamental right to legal representation. I think it can be really difficult. It can be some really confronting topics. Have I ever had that situation where, you know, someone, a friend or whoever, would come up to me and say, how do you represent a guilty client? Well, it's not really how it works. But have I ever had a situation where, you know, I feel a little bit uncomfortable representing someone because my personal belief might be different? Nothing sticks out in my mind. And I think the reason for that is I always come back to, you know, the fundamental right to legal representation and the fact that, you know, I wasn't there. I didn't see it happen unless it's caught on CCTV. I'm not one to judge. I'm there to represent my client's interests and my client's instructions. So I think I just place a lot of trust on the process. I trust that, you know, the prosecutors are doing their bit on behalf of complainants and the community. And, you know, I'm doing mine for and representing the interests of my client. And then we've got the judge or the magistrate to make an informed decision from there. So I think I always bring it back to that basic that I wasn't there and this person has a right to have someone defend them. But I think at the end of the day, most times, I would say maybe 80% of my clients are pleading guilty. You know, they know they've done the wrong thing. And it's just about ensuring that the sentence and the process is fair and they get a sentence that reflects their crime, but also their personal circumstances. So like Susie, I have a really big focus on rehabilitation. I think that that's really what makes the biggest difference. If we can focus more on that, it means a whole stream of issues are addressed in terms of incarceration rates. And I think the focus should be there, and the law's starting to focus in that area too. There's been some really good case law come out in the last couple of years and changes to the legislation to focus more on rehabilitation where it's appropriate. And I think that my job is just to advocate on people's behalf and make sure that they get the right result at the end. So
That's really positive. And I'll just make a note here that in case anyone who's listening is going through any difficult times or has been exposed to any material, we might, the UNLSA might endeavour to put some links to resources that you could access in the show notes in case this is you and you are looking for help. Advocacy in the theatre of the courtroom underlies a lot of criminal law work. With COVID-19 and virtual appearances, do either of you feel that expectations and roles of criminal lawyers have changed? And if so, do you think they'll be permanent? Susie, I might ask you first.
I think the biggest thing that I notice and the first thing that comes to my mind when I think about COVID-19 and protocols is that when you're appearing on AVL, we've had very big debates in the office over whether you stand up or not. Because it's a video conference and it just shows the bench and you just think, do I need to stand up? Because that's the typical practice here. But aside from that joke, I think things have definitely changed for the better. Flexibility with appearances, it really needed to be implemented from the get-go. People's personal circumstances are going to change, health is going to change. And of course, for maybe it's more the client-focused side for defence solicitors, because sometimes their clients might live in a regional or rural area and it was just quite difficult. You've got a matter in the Sydney CBD at the Downing Centre. Public transport and parking in that area, they're okay, but they're expensive. It's just hard to get to. And if your matter's being pushed there from Gosford, then it's much more appropriate for you to be appearing via AVL if that is a possibility. So the fact that the system is now there, the software that we use in the courts isn't necessarily flawless. There, it's like Zoom, there's dropouts, audio issues, people disappear. I remember I was there and I then suddenly everything went black and I thought, oh my goodness. But it happens all the time. But knowing that, I hope that it remains an option after the pandemic, because flexibility of appearance should have been there from the start.
Yeah, and Zoe, do you have anything to add on that point?
Definitely agree with the anxiety of a poor internet connection when you're appearing via AVL. Dealing with those issues has been interesting. I think that it's been positive because it's made courts more efficient. I think it's still really important, though, when, of course, we've moved on from this season. It's really important that there remain still in-person appearances when it matters. So, there's a lot of administrative mentions and things like case conference mentions and charge certification mentions and adjournment applications that so easily can be done via email or via an AVL. But I think it's important that, justice always needs to be seen to be done. And so having people in a courtroom for hearings and for sentence matters as well, it's important that everyone is there in person. I think it really makes a difference to the dynamic of advocacy and the courtroom and the way, I guess, justice is delivered. So I think that that's important, but I totally agree. The efficiency is so much better.
Yeah, it sounds like the possibility for a really positive behavioural change, even if we have to introduce some new forms of court etiquette, such as stand up and sit down and leaving the bar effectively unattended. Just this question's a little bit more pointed towards you, Zoe, because I wanted to say a massive congratulations on founding your own firm this year. I know you've mentioned it a little bit earlier on, but can you tell us a bit about your decision to open your own practice and your vision for W & Co Lawyers?
Yeah, of course. Thank you very much. It's still very new. It wasn't an easy decision. Like I think I mentioned before, I was so lucky and so grateful to have the role that I had before. But I think that there was a big overriding reason why I'm back in Newcastle, and it's because I grew up in Newcastle and my husband and I always knew we wanted to live in Newcastle. Sydney never really felt like home to us, and we knew that one day when we have kids, we want them to have a backyard, not live in an apartment, and just that lifestyle balance. I think you like Newcastle is so lucky to have, the beach right there, but a big enough city to have a career in. It's just something that has been really important to both of us. So it was always the goal. But in terms of the decision to go out and do it on my own, I think I got to a point where I had some really valuable mentoring other people, but also, you know, the types of work I was doing as well. And I think that being able to bring that back to Newcastle is really valuable. I've appeared in front of lots of different magistrates and judges and had lots of different types of matters. So being able to bring that experience back to Newcastle is really good. And along with that, I think the reason for deciding to go out on my own is that I needed to take a new step. I think it's important to push outside of your comfort zone. I think that's something that I always need to remind myself with. I'm that sort of type A personality where I like to be in control and have my nice little cushioned area to live my life. But it's definitely the case where if you push out of your comfort zone, you know, you learn new things and you grow. So, and I've already seen that in my practice since starting. So I think that's important. And being able to be part of the Newcastle community as an advocate for my clients, but also getting involved with the uni and making sure that, I don't know if things have changed, but if people who are coming through uni and want to do criminal law and they don't know where to turn, I want to be that person who can kind of guide them on the right track and help them out and not make them feel too lost if they're not applying for their commercial law firms. So
yeah, honestly, that would have been greatly appreciated. I know it's still, I guess there's a difference in criminal law. They might not have the most structured process. Mm. It is easy to feel a little bit left behind in the higher and graduate sphere. So hopefully it'll be really great, and we'll see a lot more of W&Co lawyers into the future.
Thank you.
And then I guess to round out our discussion today, being a young lawyer in the criminal law seems pretty daunting from the outside looking in. So can you each tell me something that you wished you had known when you were at law school? We might start with you, Susie.
I think I wished I'd known that, I mean, you kind of know this. You know this in your heart. You know that people mess up. You know that people make mistakes and that not everything is sunshine and roses, and even the most experienced advocates can stand there and fumble on their feet. But there was something quite special about seeing it in the flesh, seeing people. I mean, it sounds so funny to make fun of people messing up, but it was so humanizing to something that seemed so impossible. You know, how could someone like me, you know, just go into the law and just be like, yeah, okay, I'm an advocate now. But it was knowing that and remembering and reminding myself that everyone is human and we're all just fumbling along and we're all going to make mistakes was very, very calming, because when you're new, when you're going into it, everything's so daunting and you're so afraid to mess up because you don't want to ruin your career, but like you're not going to, because yeah, everyone's human. And I've had, I think my one of my favorite moments was starting and appearing before a registrar and saying, "Good morning, Your Honor." And thankfully, Registrar Galanis at the Supreme Court is a lovely man and just looked at me and went, "Have you had your coffee?" And we're all on AVL, and I thought, no, I haven't. But I think he gets it all the time from even experienced.
Yeah, people. That's what I was going to say. Says if you just sat in the court, if that was your first time, if you just sat in the court for 15 more minutes, you would have seen other practitioners with 30, 40 years of experience calling a registrar Your Honour as well. But yeah, making sure you, you know, you feel at the time like it's mortifying to call them Your Honour, but it's not a big deal.
Yeah, it almost sounds like the mum-dad distinction outside of law.
Oh gosh, it was pretty mortifying, but it was a good, it's nice messing up because it is, they're quite well, like hilarious memories, you know, many months on. And I can imagine many years on, you can look back on something that you were quite embarrassed about, but and look at it with pleasure. But that's probably, yeah, my biggest advice for, you know, any other type A personalities like other lawyers, to say it's fine to be human, it's fine to be scared, it's fine to mess up, because you will. But everyone does.
Yeah. Oh, that's great to hear. And Zoe, did you have anything you'd like to add?
I think that is a perfect answer. I've got three quick things. Mm-hmm. The first one, like I said before, is follow your heart. You'll end up where you want to be, hopefully. I don't know that for sure, but it worked out for me, and I've seen it work out for other people as well. So just follow your heart and stay in your own lane. The second one is to reach out to your contacts, as I mentioned before. I think that can make a huge difference, particularly in criminal law. And then the third one, following on from what Susie said, is to acknowledge that you don't need to be the most confident person to succeed in a career in crime. I'm not the person who would get up in front of a room of people and feel really comfortable speaking. I just kind of get in this zone where I just block out everyone sitting at the back of the courtroom and just focus on me and the magistrate or me and the judge. And yeah, you don't need to feel like you need to be the most confident person. And I think I struggled with that as a graduate. I thought, you know, this is what I want to do, but am I good enough? Can I do this? Because I, you know, don't feel like the most comfortable person in the courtroom, and I need to check, you know, the law or my submissions 10 times before I say it out loud, just in case I've got something wrong. But you just keep pressing forward. I've really grown to learn that maybe lack of confidence is my power, because it means that I, you know my stuff, I'm prepared. If I was overly confident, then maybe I'd forget to dot my I's and cross my T's. And, you know, I think that those details matter. And I think that at the end of the day, you know, you will have lots of experiences where someone who's more confident than you might make you second guess yourself. I think it's part of every profession. I had a matter recently where the prosecutor before the hearing kind of came up to me and laughed in my face as to why I was running a plea of not guilty and defending the charge, and asked if I understood the law. And of course I said to him, yes, I do. And in my head, I was like, I don't know. Do I? I think I do. I've been spending hours on this, but what if I'm wrong? You know, I'm going to be totally embarrassed in court, and you know, the magistrate's going to yell at me for wasting time. But at the end of the day, I just stuck to my gut, and I knew that I'd prepared, and the client was found not guilty. And it's just one of those lessons where, you know, you may have that type of personality who stresses and worries and second guesses themselves, but that's a real power in this profession as well. You don't need to be loud and overly confident. You can be quieter and more focused and do a really good job for your clients and make a difference.
Yeah, that's great. Sounds like be prepared is really the recipe for success, at least for type A personalities.
Yes, I think so. Which we always will be prepared. So it's not really something we have to worry too much to do.
Yeah. All right. Well, I guess that is all we have time for today. I want to say a massive thank you again, Zoe and Susie, for taking the time to appear on our podcast. And also a much broader thank you to the UNLSA for making this podcast possible. I've been your host, Sian Pickard, and have a great day.